Our next, I'm very pleased that we have a very high-ranking and distinguished panel for our discussion on Russia. Russia's borders do not end anywhere. This is, you can just take a seat here. So I start again with this famous quote by the Russian president who said, Russia's borders do not end anywhere. This is what the Russian president has jokingly told a schoolboy in a TV show in 2016. On a more serious note, we have indeed witnessed in recent years that Russia has significantly expanded the scope of its foreign policy and has expanded the reach also beyond the post-Soviet sphere, the traditional sphere of influence, and tried to re-establish itself as a global power. We want to discuss today in which areas engagement with Russia can still be possible, especially in light and also perhaps especially despite the current developments and the current escalation in the Sea of Azov. It's my great honor and pleasure to welcome, first of all, the Estonian Minister of Defense, Mr. Jüri Lüb. Thank you very much. Yes, you can already take a seat. Whichever you prefer. Then it's my great pleasure to welcome Rose Gottemüller on stage, Deputy Secretary General of NATO. Alexei Pushkov, Chairman of the Committee on Information and Media in the Russian Council. Perhaps in the middle. And then we also have Alexander Graf Lambsdorff, Deputy Chairman of the FDP Parliamentary Group, and Philip Barton, Director General for Consular and Security in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. It's a pleasure that Frederick Pleitgen from CNN is going to moderate the discussion. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. So when Liana and I were talking about this panel before I started, we were saying, you know, we'll talk a little bit about Syria, we'll talk a little bit about Libya maybe, and then she said, you should definitely do some Ukraine as well, and I said, really? And then the Sea of Azov happened and everything kind of changed. So one of the things that's obviously positive for our panel is that we are now, as we call it, in a breaking news environment where obviously a lot of things are changing, but we also have a very high-level discussion about a topic that is right now in the news and that is very important. And I know you might see an order of speakers here on your sheet. I'm going to forget about that because I think that considering what's been going on the past couple of days in the Sea of Azov, that we might want to hear from our Russian participant, Mr. Alexei Pushkov, first, because it looks like this is another major international incident that sort of pits Russia against Ukraine, but then also, of course, against many other international players. And it seems sometimes, I think, to us in the West that Vladimir Putin's government just simply doesn't care about the international outrage and is willing to risk a lot to get what he wants. What's your take?
Well, I think that this episode, which happened in the Sea of Azov, is a bit overblown. Nothing.
They did shoot at a couple of ships and wound a couple of guys.
This is true, but the outrage of the international community seems a little bit strange to Moscow, because before this date, 15 Russian ships were detained by the Ukrainian side in the last year, and nobody said a word about that. And their crews were kept on the ship virtually in a state of prisoners for weeks, and the captain was threatened with of one of those ships with a trial and 5 years of prison by the Ukrainian side. So it's a story which has been going for a long time. But when Ukraine did that, Ukraine is the darling boy of the Western media, and so nobody was writing about this, although Ukraine was breaking international law. And when the incident occurred with Russian participation and led to this upsurge in tension, evidently it's all over the place and so on. But I think yesterday evening Putin had a telephone conversation with Poroshenko. They discussed other issues, but the fact that they had this conversation after, I think, a couple of, even 3 months of no telephone conversations shows that There is a desire on both sides to keep this tension under control. So I would not really consider this as a new stage of the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. It's rather the continuation of those incidents in the Azov Sea. And we warned the Ukrainian side for a long time that we will not put up with those arrests of the Russian ships. Look, 15 ships, it's a lot. And so finally there was this incident, and in a way the Ukrainians, I think, did not took our warnings seriously enough. But there are a number of other things which are going on in the world which are much more serious than this incident. For instance, the coming back to the discussion we just had at the lunch, the recognition of Jerusalem by the United States is much more important by its long-term consequences than this.
All right, well, let's stay with Ukraine for
yes,
now.
Yes, yes.
I missed the lunch.
I want to give you the right criteria. I mean, this will be forgotten in a week's time. I don't think it will influence things a lot.
But it's highly likely that the next thing is going to spring up because, I mean, as we know, eastern Ukraine, generally that Crimea area has been one of massive tension. But Rose Gotemeller, isn't one of the issues that that NATO has and that the West has, especially as far as Ukraine conflict is concerned, and this is something that President Obama spoke about towards the end of his term, that the Russian side is willing to escalate a lot more than the Western side, than for instance, NATO or than the West is in any sort of dealings as far as Ukraine is concerned?
Well, let me just begin by a few comments. I want to underscore that from NATO's perspective, we always underline the necessity for all in this conflict to act in accordance with international law. That's why we talked to both the Ukrainian and the Russian sides about fulfilling their commitments under the Minsk, so-called Minsk process, working together with Germany and France. We've been very, very supportive of that. But I think none of us will forget that picture of the large tanker across the Kerch Strait under the bridge that was illegally constructed by the Russian Federation toward territory that is controlled by Russia at the moment, but unfortunately in contravention of international law, it's Ukrainian territory. Ukrainian territorial integrity and sovereignty has been breached by the Russian seizure of Crimea. So let's get that straight from the outset. So that's the very first point. The other point I want to stress, though, is the one that Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, was making yesterday, and that is that we need to bring the temperature down. I'm glad to see the temperatures come down. Talk about news flashes. I just saw Deputy Foreign Minister Grushko across town declared in another forum that the military phase of this crisis is over. Well, hope to God it is. But I think the most important thing is to bring the temperature down and for Russia to return those sailors and those ships to Ukraine.
Minister, look, you have to be looking at this with great concern because, I mean, if the Russians are willing to use their military muscle down there, presumably they're a threat to your country as well.
Well, we are looking with great concern. And we are looking with great concern because these acts, of course, violation of international treaties and international laws by the Russian Federation. As I said, and actually as you pointed out, we are talking about a situation whereby ships of one sovereign country are shooting at the ships of another sovereign country. Ships, Ukrainian ships, which are leaving from the territory of the incident. And of course, when you try to stop a ship, you usually, if it is necessary at all, you try to shoot in front of it just to signal. Shot across the bow, just to indicate your displeasure that they are leaving. You don't actually.
strong indication of displeasure.
Yeah, you don't actually shoot at another ship. So we have now people who are, if you will, wounded in battle, I mean, for practical purposes. So I consider this act a very aggressive act. And obviously, it's part of the general conflict, the Russian aggression to Ukraine. So in a way, it's true that we cannot look at it separately. But what I'm worried about is the situation where the level of attention scrutinizing these incidents goes so low, our bar is so low, that one country shooting at another country's ships, we usually use the term incident already. I mean, it's nothing more than an incident. And of course, by that, we reduce the importance and gravity of the situation. And I'm afraid that this is something which happened in the war between Georgia and Russia, that especially in Abkhazia, also in South Ossetia, there was a lot of shooting of that nature. And then at some point, somebody's nerves give up and you have a reason for aggression, like Russia aggressively entered the Georgian territory. So that kind of tension is up in the air. I mean, you can feel it. Mm. From news.
Because I'm really glad that we have Philip Barton here from the Foreign Commonwealth Office, because one of the countries that has been taking a very tough stance towards the Russians recently, not just since Salisbury, but especially since then, has been the UK. What do you expect from Britain's allies, and what's Britain's line going to be towards the Russians with this new foreign policy that we're talking about?
So I think, you know, I'm glad you asked me that question. I think it's important when you're in a news breaking news cycle, actually you step back and look at the strategic picture. So what we've seen for a period of years now is some very hostile Russian acts aimed at the United Kingdom and our friends, allies, and partners. And I think what we are trying to do is, together with those friends, allies, and partners, and I'd include Ukraine in that number, is build our resilience, make sure we protect ourselves, but also come together and do things which constrain the most egregious aspects of that Russian behaviour. So you mentioned the Salisbury incident, which was a terribly shocking thing, the use of, you know, a deadly chemical nerve agent on the streets of Salisbury by agents of the Russian state. And I think the most heartening thing for me about the way we were able to respond to that was the fact that it wasn't just the UK that took action. It was a large number of countries who chose to join us in expelling Russian intelligence officers. And I think that sent a very clear message. I think what we need to do is come together, as NATO has done, as the EU has done, as the OECD is, as I expect the G7 to do, to send a clear signal when we see something like Salisbury or something like the incident of the CSSR, that this isn't acceptable. Mm.
Alexander Gramsdamsons, one of the things that I think Liana was saying at the beginning is obviously looking for ways to work with this new emboldened Russia and what role Germany could play. And if we look at the incident in the Azov Sea, Germany has volunteered to play a moderating role in all of it. I think that Vladimir Putin said that he would welcome it, but Sergei Lavrov apparently this morning said that he doesn't think it's necessary. What role do you think that Germany could play now and in general to mediate between Russia and the West?
Well, I mean, first of all, let me say that I, strangely enough, agree with both Rose Gottemalet and Alexei Pushkov. One, Crimea was seized illegally. It is not Russian territory. The bridge is illegal. There's no doubt about it. But I agree with Alexei Pushkov in that I believe that the Azov Sea incident, the blocking of the Strait of Kerch, and the subsequent reopening of it and the de-escalation that we've seen, that we hope to continue with the return of the vessels and the sailors, is not something that's entirely new, that would not lift this conflict to a new stage. It is the continuation of the Ukrainian-Russian conflict that we've seen in the Donbas. It is its manifestation in a spot that many experts have predicted. And so I tend to agree that if de-escalation continues, which we would hope, it is an incident that will not have sort of that will not be inscribed in our memory like Salisbury or MH17. The other,
but you're talking about that's, it's interesting Germany, that you mention these things, yeah. I'm sorry to cut you off, but you're mentioning all these incidents. You're talking about MH17. You're talking about Salisbury. We can also talk about Syria. Mm-hmm. We can talk about the Donbas. We can mm-hmm. talk about many other things. There seem to be a lot of areas right now where Russia is at odds with many countries in the West. And so back to you, Alexei Pushkov. At what point did the Russians decide to take the gloves off and ruthlessly follow their interests in places like Syria? We know that they have big business interests now, or trying to get big business interests in Libya. We had a recent meeting with General Haftar who came over to Russia. You had the Sudanese president who was in Russia meeting, among others, with Yevgeny Prigozhin. When did Russia decide that it's going to have its own global foreign policy and it was going to follow that foreign policy as ruthlessly as we're seeing now?
Well, I like your question with the exception of the word ruthless, because I think that we are we act quite quite responsibly, taking the conditions in which the world today is. For instance, we stay inside the INF Treaty, which is not evident to survive after
Putin's question that treaty as well.
Yes, answering to the word ruthless. There are some actors that are much more ruthless than us on certain issues. So if you ask me for a date, I think that as a symbolic date, you can take the address of Vladimir Putin to Munich on February 11, 2007. When his basically what he said at the Munich conference at that point was that the unipolar world is not working in an efficient way. It does not correspond neither to the interest of Russia nor to the interest of a number of countries in the world, and it should be reconsidered, and Russia will not follow the rules of the unipolar world. That was when it happened, and if you want a short prehistory of this, of this speech, it was after two waves of NATO expansion, at the point when the United States were trying to get Ukraine and Georgia into NATO, when the United States walked out of the ABM treaty, when there was the aggression against Iraq, which went against all rules of international law, and you know that even inside the Western alliance there was a huge discord on the Iraqi war. France, Germany have not supported it. So after we have seen that this world centered on the United States and its closest allies works in a very weird way. And it's not a much better world than was in the times of the Cold War, because instead of this Cold War confrontation, we had a number of new confrontations all over, and ending by the Iraqi war. And at that point, I think that somewhere in 2005, 2006, Russia decided that we have to have our own more independent policy centered on our national interests, and not on just following, say, what the United States suggests to us, because it leads to nowhere.
Do you think Russia's better off now? Sanctioned, widely isolated, do you think that that's better than what the alternative would have been?
Russia is isolated on the Western side. It's not isolated in the world. If you look at the number of top-level meetings the Russian president has in the world, all over the globe, you will hardly speak about isolation. And there was an interesting question in the morning today: would Russia agree to be a junior partner to China? And I think that there are two questions which stem from this question. First, what kind of relationship is suggested to us by the Western alliance? Because China offers us some kind of partnership without preconditions. That's the first. And then, won't almost everyone feel in some time a junior country to China? The question is partner or just junior? And so China is a country which exists just as such a mighty factor that, yes, we consider that our relationship with China is extremely important. And the economic strength of China is counterbalanced to a certain extent by the political influence of Russia, its nuclear power status and its territory, its resources. So, no, we don't feel a junior partner to China.
Can I just say...
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
There's one point I'd like to make.
And I cut you off in your answer.
There seems to be an astonishment about the fact that Russia wants to play a global role. Russia has been a global power for a very long time. It was a big mistake by President Obama to call Russia a regional power. Russia is the only country that borders China, the United States, and Europe. Russia is a P5 member of the United Nations Security Council. Russia has strategic nuclear arms. I think it is not surprising that Russia wants to play a global role. The question is, how does it play that role? That it plays that role. And when, for example, the United States say in the Syrian conflict that they draw a red line into the sand, the use of chemical weapons would lead to American action, and nothing ensues, and there's a vacuum, and Russia moves into that vacuum, analytically, I cannot hold that against Russia. What you can hold against Russia is then the way it plays the role, violating humanitarian international law.
I think Philip Barton might have a few words to say about that, because I mean, playing a global role doesn't necessarily mean sending spies to Britain and poisoning people with...
That's exactly what I'm saying. How you play that role is a completely different matter of whether you have a role to play or not.
So I agree with Alexander. And you heard me say earlier that what we're trying to do in the UK is build our partnerships in terms of protecting ourselves, but we also absolutely understand the need to engage and have a dialogue with Russia. For the UK, we share with Russia. We're both nuclear powers and permanent members of the UN Security Council. And when we look at the big international security issues the world faces, whether that's in the Korean Peninsula or the Middle East, we absolutely want to have a dialogue with Russia. And clearly, Russia has national interests, and it's perfectly legitimate for them to want to advance those. But it's the way that Russia, at times, chooses to go about them that causes all of us a problem and a difficulty. And just finally, if you'll put me, I can't quite let the INF comment stand. And the key point on INF is that Russia is in breach of the treaty.
That's, I know Rose wants to, you want to
I assume we'll come back to INF, but it's inevitable. But I actually wanted to comment on something else. Yeah. And that is my knowledge and experience working with Russia for many years is that Russia indeed has mutual interests with the West, with the United States of America, my own country. I'm here representing NATO at the moment, but there are strong mutual interests. Russia has been a leader with the United States in constraining weapons of mass destruction, for example, the famous Syria example. I think that's a great vignette to illustrate exactly what we're talking about. After that famous red line in the sand, it was Moscow who came up with the idea of getting a handle on the Syrian chemical weapons arsenal. Together with Russia, we got 1,200 tons of nerve agent and chemical weapons out of Syria in 2013, 2014. It was an international effort, but led with Russia, led by Russia, the United States, and a number of other European powers, a great project. Russia encouraged Bashar al-Assad to sign up to the CWC, the Chemical Weapons Convention. But here's the great lesson of all this. Russia then did not hold his feet to the fire and demand that he live up to that norm, to that constraint on chemical weapons use. We have seen confirmed chemical weapons use by the Assad regime in Syria. So, this is the problem here. We have great examples of Russian leadership working to constrain proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. And then we have great examples where they're not stepping up to the responsibility to these important international
regimes. Just go to the INF treaty for a second, though, because I know that Mr. Pushkov said it's the Americans who want to get out of them, and you sure said that the Russians are in breach of the agreement. Isn't the reality of the matter that both the U.S. and Russia believe that the treaty is obsolete? Because I heard the U.S. National Security Advisor, Mr. Bolton, in Moscow. He was asked whether or not, if the Russians came into compliance with the INF, if the U.S. was interested in keeping it. And he didn't seem like he was interested at all, because the U.S. seems to believe that that it's obsolete because the Chinese can develop any sort of weapons and deploy them as they like. So they just don't think that it's something worth keeping around anymore.
Well, the existence...
Isn't that sort of the death knell of that treaty?
No. The existence of intermediate-range nuclear missiles on the Eurasian periphery in other hands aside from Soviet, Russian, U.S. hands has been known for some time now. They are, being deployed by the Chinese, by DPRK, by India, by Pakistan, by Iran, indeed. And so there are a number of countries who are deploying these missiles on the Eurasian periphery. This was recognized back in 2007 when Russia and the United States took a proposal to the Conference on Disarmament to multilateralize the treaty. It never got worked on at that time. I'm not quite sure what the issue was. I was not in government at that time. But it's long been recognized that the treaty deserves a multilateralization effort. That said, excuse me to all, my voice is a bit off today thanks to a cold, but that said, I really think that the treaty continues to play an important role, again, constraining these missiles, and in the view certainly of the NATO alliance, it is up to Russia to answer the questions that have been raised for many years about their compliance with INF. I was the first to demarche the Russians in 2003 on this issue, so I'm sorry, 2013 on this issue, so I'm quite aware of the long history. But that's the key point, and NATO is saying that is the key point. Let's see what Russia has to say about the U.S. questions about its non-compliance with the treaty.
You heard Mr. Lambsdorff say that he doesn't blame Russia for having a globalized foreign policy, but that's got to be a bit concerning for someone who's neighboring Russia.
Well, I would agree with Mr. Lambsdorff that, basically, we have nothing against Russia having a global foreign policy. And the question is really in terms of methods. And I think the biggest problem is that we see in Estonia Russia as a revanchist power, a power which is saddened by the fact that the might which they used to have during the Cold War as a Soviet Union has disappeared or has weakened considerably. And there is a desire to change the security system, both global and European security system, in a way that it would still provide Russia with relative power. But since not having economic means, and I would even say not military means, I'm not talking about comparing Russia with Estonia, but I'm comparing about the in the big balance of things. So Russia is prone to use aggressive means, believing that somehow this helps to disrupt the system and provide it with comparative advantage. I think it's a fundamental mistake. I believe that the present institutions as they stand, for instance, NATO, which has now enlarged to the Baltic states, are a great tool of stability, for instance, in the Baltic Sea region, which is a relatively stable region, and where NATO provides a role of deterring any possible military adventurism. We were extremely lucky as Balts to get into NATO when we got into NATO in 2004. Nobody would take us to NATO now. These were.
I'm sure.
It's true. Let's imagine the situation as it stands today. In 2004, all the stars were aligned. Even President Putin said, "I don't like it, but I won't go to war for it or against it." So,
but then if it's a factor of stability, I know you were highly critical of NATO enlargement, as are most Russian politicians, but if it's such a factor for stability, then why do we have, aside from all the things like the Syria conflict, aside from Salisbury, why is there so much friction, especially on the lines between NATO and Russia at the moment? You have Trident Juncture, which the Russians weren't happy about. Of course, the Russians put on Vostok, which I know was not in the fringe of NATO, but was their largest military exercise since 1981. You have planes that are being intercepted on one side, then you have planes that are being intercepted on the other side. Why does there have to be so much friction at the moment? You'd like to answer. Defense Minister, of course.
Just one remark. Nobody is against the doing exercises. I mean, that's what the military does. The question is, would you invite observers? Are these exercises transparent? Would you do snap exercises? Because that's one of the extremely risky type of exercises, where you don't give warning, but you mobilize a large amount of troops suddenly and with unclear intentions. I must say that the Russian military has done a number of large-scale snap exercises, and that is something which is a matter of big concern to us.
Well, I just wonder why Russia is measured by a completely different criteria than other great powers. That's what worries me. It's not a whataboutism, but look at the last, 15 years of the foreign policy of the Western alliance. It was a war in Iraq supported by 25 countries. There was a war in Libya supported by Great Britain and by France, and which ended up in a catastrophe, and everybody in Europe recognizes that. There were a number of other very controversial decisions taken by the United States and their allies. But this is considered to be, you know, the United States tried to get away easy with that. They say it was a mistake. You know, Iraq was a mistake. It was not a mistake. It was a strategy. It was a huge war which lasted for 10 years that devastated the whole Middle East and brought to power ISIS. It was a tragedy, I would say. It's not a mistake. So when I'm being said that it's not that the fact that Russia plays a global role, which is worrisome, but the way it plays. And what about the way other big powers are playing a global role? Why don't we consider this part of the dialogue? Why Russia is on the trial? And these are just small mistakes. Tony Blair saying in the House of Commons that Saddam Hussein chemical weapons can reach London in 45 minutes is what? It's a mistake or it's a lie? So I just want to establish a certain set of criteria for all the great powers in this case. And Russia can be criticized for certain things. But why is only Russia criticized for these things? And answering your question about this Russia-NATO, I would say frictions, as you said, I think that in this situation when we have lost this mechanism of dialogue, the council between Russia and NATO stopped to function, basically. It does not work anymore.
No.
And so the stress is on the military means. Each side shows the other side that it's full of resolve and, you know, that it can bring the military cards on the table. And so I don't think it will lead very far. I don't think so. But that's a period where the military card is being played by both sides, showing that nobody can make other, you know, accept their position. I think we will have to get out of that. I think the council should be revived at some point. I think we have to get back to a dialogue. But I don't think it should be a dialogue with preconditions. You know, if Russia does this, and that, maybe the United States will reconsider the 62 sanctions that were used against Russia in the last 3 years. It will not work this way. You know, we can't put up with those 62 sanctions. And if there is a dialogue which starts without preconditions on strategic issues, we offered that. By the way, INF treaty, you say we violate the treaty. Well, if you think we violate the treaty, we think we have some suspicions about the American actions. Let's talk about that. But I don't think the best way is, like Mr. Bolton, is to come to Moscow and say we walk out of the treaty no matter what. Let's talk about that. You accuse us, we have some suspicions. Let's talk about this. So my answer to all this is, first, everybody commits mistakes or very big mistakes on international scene. Russia is not alone, you know, to be criticized internationally. The second thing is, if we have frictions and the military is prevailing over diplomacy, let's restart some kind of diplomatic dialogue, because in the absence of this, we will be just threatening each other. And finally, we get back to the missile crisis of the 1980s. If the United States, at some point, for some reason, decide to place those missiles, intermediate range missiles in Europe, Russia will respond, and where we are. We are back to the Cold War years, before Reagan and Gorbachev agreement of 1987. And I think it's a complete deadlock. So my point is, let's restart a dialogue, but not saying that if Russia changes the behavior 100%, then we will maybe give it a place at the table. It will not work this way.
But nobody says that. Nobody says Russia.
In fact, it is.
No, it is. Exactly. Nobody says Russia has to change her behavior 100%. But it would be a good start, for example, to talk about frozen conflicts in your neighborhood where Russia is involved in every single one of them in one way or another, where you have a doctrine, really, called the near abroad, Blizhe Zarubezhye, which only assigns limited sovereignty to your neighbors in your actions. That is something that no other great power that we know of does. And I believe that is something that is fair and that is something that concerns NATO and the West greatly. So I believe acknowledging that and discussing about these things and being a bit more clear about where Russia wants to go strategically, because there's a big question mark over where your strategic aims really are, that would really be helpful. I remember this title of the Valdai Club a couple of years ago, which is sort of the Russian version of Davos, and it said, new rules or no rules, okay? So Russia says either there are new rules or we won't abide by any rules whatsoever. But then engage in a dialogue what kind of rule book you're looking for. Is it different from the Charter of the United Nations? Is it different from the OSCE? Is it different from the respect of treaties like the one guaranteeing Ukraine's territorial integrity when Ukraine gave up her nuclear weapons? What are the rule books Russia is looking for? What's the rule book? Where do you want to go? And the entire West, China as well, Japan as well, we don't know. And I believe that a little bit of transparency and clarity from Moscow would be extremely helpful.
I mean, talking about transparency, I mean, you know, for instance, if there's devastating evidence that Russian agents were involved in poisoning people in Britain, or that they tried to point an antenna at the OPCW and all had passports that almost had matching numbers and a receipt from the GRU headquarters to Sheremetyevo Airport, at some point, don't you kind of have to acknowledge that you were involved? I mean, it's one thing to say things are a mistake. It's another thing to acknowledge, yes, this was us, and it was a mistake.
I think transparency is very important. I mean, you know, I would take 10%. You know, I don't think we are asking for 100%. You know, why can't Russia tomorrow stop the cyber attacks it's mounting on a regular basis on our democracies and on, you mentioned the OPCW, on international institutions and so on? That's a choice that Russia could make. That's not everything that they're doing that we don't like, but that would be a fantastic start. And I think it's wrong for us to think that because others have made mistakes, and you raised the Iraq war and you raised Tony Blair, that somehow excuses bad behaviour going forwards. What happened in the United Kingdom in the wake of the Iraq war is we had a very, very open, thorough and transparent inquiry into exactly who decided what when, and we learnt some lessons, and there were some harsh political lessons as well out of that process, and that's what open democratic societies do. So I don't think we can use Iraq as an excuse for what Russia does today.
One more. Rose.
Yes, I just had one more example. First, I would say the NATO-Russia Council is alive and kicking. We've had 8 meetings in the last couple of years, so in addition, we have military-to-military dialogue going on between the top military leadership of NATO and the Russian Chad General Gerasimov. So the dialogue is there. It's part of our approach, which is deterrence and defense must be matched by dialogue. But from where I sit, once again, having been involved on the INF treaty issue since 2013, I would very much welcome Russia opening up a dialogue on what the 9M729 missile is or is not. You're quite right, Alexei, that there is a view out there that, this is not a missile, and it's been conveyed, as I understand officially, this missile does not violate the INF treaty. Well, let's sit down and talk about it. What we saw instead was 5 years of stonewalling, frankly, from Moscow, not being ready to sit down and talk about this missile. So I was very glad a couple of weeks ago when I saw Minister of Foreign Affairs Lavrov say that Russia was turning its attention to answering the questions that the administration had posed to them last June about the missile. That's a great first step. Let's sit down and start to talk to each other about the concerns that the U.S. has. And Russia has the right, of course, to raise the concerns that Russia has about the United States and its compliance with the treaty. But this is a case where I feel like we were knocking on the door for 5 years and never had anybody open it.
And the instruments are there. There are confidence-building instruments, like what Yuri just mentioned about the maneuvers. Mm-hmm. We have the OSCE Vienna document. There are certain rules there that you can follow. If you have a maneuver, an exercise with more than 13,000 soldiers, you invite observers. It's there. It just needs to be applied. And then to Zapad, the maneuver in the West, yeah. Was, funnily enough, was 12,900 soldiers. All the images showed it was more like 40,000, but that's the kind of thing. That's not 100%. It's trying to re-engage in a dialogue, because let's be very clear. I think the big strategic change on the international stage, is China's rise. It is not so much the conflicts between Russia and NATO. Yes, we have these conflicts, and of course we don't accept Russia's behavior vis-à-vis its neighbors. Yes, but we all have a common interest in managing the rise of China in the international system in the 21st century. That is something where I believe Russia and the West have a common interest. There are other common interests, energy, climate change, what you name it. I mean, we're talking about possibilities for engagement. I think that's the headline of this panel. There are lots of things where we can engage and do things together, but it would be extremely helpful if we would come back to an atmosphere of dialogue in applying the instrument that Rose Gottemüller just mentioned. I mean, NATO-Russia Council is meeting, yes, but there are other things that we can do, that Russia can do.
I would love to keep going this way, but we're going to open the floor to questions now. And I have been advised that the first question goes to Mr. Gigi Mantas Pavilionis, who is a member of the SEIMAS Foreign Affairs Committee. And there he is, sir. He rigged the system. He gets the first question.
Thank you so much. My question goes to Ms. Cottemayer. Well, what do you think is the strategic goal of Transatlantic Alliance? To calming down the temperatures, as you said, to de-escalate the escalation? That sounds similar to Gerasimov doctrine, because this is the way Russians are trying to build or rebuild their empire in the abroad. Or we should go back to some kind of more ambitious goals, in a way to the goals that saved the Baltic souls, to strengthen the defense of our transatlantic alliance, maybe to create new, deeper trade links, you know, to strengthen our energy cooperation, to come back to Europe whole and free, to come back to enlargement policies, and maybe to think strategically about Russia. How do we transform that dictatorship there that is actually destroying our democracies, destroying our Europe whole and free? And for the last 10 years after Bucharest, big mistakes we made, you know, where we succumb to their pressure, maybe it's time to come back to kind of Baltic agenda that created the success the Estonian Estonian defense minister was referring to.
I have to stress that NATO has particular core tasks. In recent years, the focus has been on collective defense because of the actions Russia took, seizing Crimea in 2014, destabilizing the Donbass afterwards, creating tensions up against NATO borders that has led to a great increase in our collective defense emphasis again after years of, I would say, paying more attention to the fight against terrorism, which is related to another of our core tasks. But I want to say that NATO is a defensive alliance. It is focused on defense and security concerns of the NATO allies, and so it really focuses in that area. Other issues that you raise, sir, such as perhaps a broader look at energy and how energy could be delivered in Europe, other issues to do with trade and economic matters, they are not for NATO per se. But I do want to emphasize that NATO as a defensive alliance, in looking at cooperative defense, we always have in mind that the actions we take are in line with international law and are both defensive and limited in their size and scope, so proportionate, as we say. And so I do want to emphasize that. We will take steps to ensure that our allies are defended, but proportionate and in line with international law, defensive in nature.
How do you feel about that, Minister?
Well, very much share with what Rose said. Obviously, I am saddened, deeply saddened by the fact that this vision of Europe whole and free has been fractured to some extent. And I very much agree with Senator Pushkov that this is to do with the sort of Putin's Munich speech approach, if you will. And although it is still and remains in the Bucharest books that Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO, and I always emphasize to them, look at the history of the Baltic states. Never say never. The moment might come. You should be ready for it when the moment comes. But I have to admit that the Russian policy towards Georgia and towards Ukraine, a deliberate policy to slow down their NATO membership, yes, has made it much more difficult. There's no doubt about it.
Do you want to add anything?
I totally agree. I believe that it's been the Western Alliance's stand, also the European Union's stand, to avoid members with territorial conflicts. And, of course, with Russia delivering these territorial conflicts to her neighbors, it slows the integration. Our colleague from the SEMAS is completely right on that one. I'm not sure whether your answer is correct, but I believe that the analysis is spot on, which is also why, and we spoke about this over lunch, I don't think the Azov Sea incident that we started with is really changing the game dramatically. What has changed the game is the annexation of Crimea and the Donbass, which has created this territorial conflict in Ukraine, which makes it difficult for Ukraine to realize her Euro-Atlantic aspirations.
Mm. Another question over there. Sorry, you'll be next.
Thank you, Evgeny Breckerman, Minsdal, Director Initiative, Belarus. As someone who comes from what we call an in-between state, I keep asking myself a very silly question, and let me pose this silly question to the panel. Graf Lambsdorff mentioned that there are lots of things which can be done, but the atmosphere is not there. So the silly question is the following. Under the present condition of no proper atmosphere, is there anything in terms of international security that both Russia and the West can agree on? And to be more specific, do you think there is any specific security problem which can be resolved and used as a case study to demonstrate that we are not yet doomed? Thank you.
Right. Pushkov.
Well, I think there was such an issue on which we were quite united. But then came Mr. Trump, and he somehow has broken this unity. That's Iran. And I think that Iran was a very good example of the capacity of the Western nations and Russia and China to agree on the prevention of a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. And you know that Iranians play along. Iranians are still playing along, even though the United States have walked out of the treaty. I know the United States experts and political class are very divided on this. Quite a few people, like John Kerry and many others, think it's a big mistake of the Trump administration. I still think it's a big mistake. I think that maybe in some time the United States will be back to the deal, because what the administration demands from Iran is absolutely unfeasible. You know, to end up the work on ballistic missiles, to end up any kind of influence in the region, and give greater guarantees on the nuclear deal. The Iranians will never agree on that. They would probably maybe agree on one of the three elements of this, but never on three. It's an issue of sovereignty and national dignity. So those are unfeasible demands. So I think and here I have to stress that paradoxically enough, we are on the same boat with Britain, with Germany, with France, with China, on Iran, and we are waiting for a positive change of a position of the United States. I think it may happen. So that's one of the issues. The second issue is also North Korea, where Trump efforts, on the contrary, played at least a symbolically positive role, and Russia supported them from the very start at the level of the sanctions in the United Nations, and also Trump's talks with the Korean leader. And as far as I know, it's a joint position also of the Western powers. So there are quite a few issues on which we can work together. So we're not doomed. I don't think so.
Well, some issues on which Russia and the West have common interests. One is nuclear non-proliferation. The Iran case comes to mind. The second one is fighting Islamist terrorism.
I mean, that's one where I'm sorry to cut you off again. I know I've done it before. That's one where I don't understand. As someone who I travel to Syria a lot, is in Syria, it was absolutely clear that both the United States and Russia, even though it was fighting a lot of other Islamist groups, were both fighting ISIS. And yet, every time something happened, the U.S. issued some sort of statement against Russia if some airstrike went wrong, or generally said Russia wasn't fighting against ISIS, whereas Russia issued statements saying the U.S. isn't fighting ISIS. There was never a concerted effort by both sides to fight Islamic terrorism inside Syria. Both sides did their part and achieved something independent of each other. But to say that that was a concerted effort, I mean, I'm not sure anybody who's been there had seen that. And it continues until now. The situation in Idlib, the situation in eastern Syria, where we recently had Russian mercenaries try to attack some oil field. Where is the common policy?
But let's not forget one thing. And I'd like to point out a very human factor. Both the United States and Russia have suffered greatly from terrorism, from Islamist terrorist attacks. I mean, there are families in Russia, in Moscow, who have been, losing loved ones, just as in the United States or in Europe.
All the more reason.
So I think focusing on Syria, where you have a territorial war going on, is one thing, and I wouldn't disagree with your description of events there because you've been there. But however, I believe that both Russia and the West have a strong common interest in fighting that scourge of Islamist terrorism. And I think that is something. The question was, where do we have a common interest? I believe that we do have a common interest.
One more thing. I take it the speaker is from Belarus, is that correct? Mm. Yeah. Another area, it's not nearly as sexy as the weapons of mass destruction and counterterrorism problems we've been... Sexy, they're not really sexy, but these problems are front and center. But the other area that we're coming into the OSC ministerial next week, the other area is the conventional stability and security in Europe, the modernization of the Vienna document, which is a confidence-building regime that has seen better days, to be honest. Once again, well, the reference was to the fact that, Russia isn't keen to follow up on the Vienna document. So, but actually, Belarus has played a role in Vienna in trying to push refurbishment of the Vienna document, and looking at other discussions under the so-called structured dialogue to try to improve the conventional transparency and predictability. So I think that's another area that we should also be bearing in mind. The conventional arms control regimes have weakened over the years, and they need to be re-examined. They need to be refurbished.
All right. Sir, another question? Where is the mic?
Thank you. My name is Andrei Popov, Moldovan Institute for Strategic Initiatives, another country in between. During the panel, there is a nice body language moment when Minister Luik candidly confessed that today even Estonia would not be invited to be a NATO member, which followed with a kind of pattering gesture from Madame Deputy Secretary General. Well, I'd like you to develop on this body language, to put some words on in this. Minister Luik came later to say that one of the factors is Russia's much more assertive policy. Is it only this, or maybe, this is a question, to which extent the fact that there are certain rifts between European partners, allies, and America, which has been the main engine behind the previous NATO membership waves of enlargement, and without whose insistence even the Bucharest summit language on future membership commitment would not have been possible, obviously. To which extent now, you, Minister, said that I always tell Ukrainian and Georgian friends, keep working, it might happen, you never know. Interestingly, Russians think the same. Though NATO membership now is not a credible perspective in short term for Georgia and in Ukraine, but maybe it will be possible. So let's engage in certain preemptive actions. My question is, what has changed now over the last 2 years, particularly with the Trump administration and with the Russia-Georgia conflict, in terms of the NATO membership enlargement discussion? Thank you.
You want to start on this? Or shall I start?
You start.
Okay. The reason I was engaging in a little bit of irony here is because, in actual fact, NATO enlargement has continued. The emphasis recently has been on the Western Balkans. Montenegro entered in June of last year. We are working now with the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, and the accession talks are completed. Of course, they have to fulfill the conditions that were set in their negotiations with Greece regarding the so-called name issue. But we hope before too long to welcome them as the Republic of North Macedonia. The other thing I will say is that I take a very long view of this. Out in front of NATO headquarters, we have our flagpoles, but also a long granite slab that has the memberships of NATO. From the very earliest days of NATO, there have been some big bangs when a number of countries have entered at once, and then a period of a decade or more would go by and a country would enter, for example, when Spain entered in 1983. So I see now we've had a couple big bangs in recent times, but that granite timeline is going to continue, and at some point we are committed, as we stated at the summit meeting in July, to the Bucharest summit statement of 10 years ago, and at some point we expect to add Georgia and Ukraine to that granite timeline.
Absolutely. Very much agree. But as we have said, as we have seen, for instance, with Montenegro, then there was also an attempted coup. And as you know, Montenegrin authorities put the blame again squarely on the Russian footsteps. So we see this rather aggressive approach to stop NATO enlargement. And, of course, NATO has a clear policy that no third country has a right of veto, but there's a difference whether it's a right of veto or it's a military action, of course. So it's it makes it undeniably complicated. That's why I'm extremely proud that NATO stood firm and took Montenegro as its member. And really, I mean, just one moment describing the Baltic case. In some ways, we got in because the key word in 2002 when we were invited was terrorism, because of 2001. Everybody spoke about terrorism being the enemy of the whole world. And the territorial defense aspect, are the Baltic states defensible, which was the big issue before, it suddenly disappeared from the scene. And the second important actor was, of course, young President Putin and young President Bush. As you remember, they looked at each other's soul, and President Bush saw something very positive in President Putin's soul. So there was this minuscule moment where the relationship was different from what it usually is. And this was the keyhole where the balls slipped in. It was a very narrow passage, and we could have easily missed it. That's what I'm telling to my Georgian and Ukrainian friends. Don't lose hope. Be ready. Things might change. You can get in.
Mm. The next question over here. Yep.
My name is Salman Sheikh. I'm the founder of the Sheikh Group. We worked over the last 7-8 years on a Syrian-led political process and ideas for it. So what we've often been told that for relatively low investment, the Russians have had high returns. And we can see that in terms of the prestige as well as the positioning of Russia in the Middle East. But we've also been told that Russia can't do it alone when it comes to winning the peace. We may have won the war as such. So what's next? And my question particularly to you, Chairman Pushkov, is Russia looking for a global strategic partner when it comes to a Syrian political process? Could that partner be the United States, especially since the United States more recently has talked about even its own interests in terms of reaching a political solution in Syria? And what could those elements be, aside from fighting terrorism, which many would say is a symptom of the Syrian conflict? What are the particular areas that could help to build such a political process?
Thank you.
Well, if there is an area, a geopolitical area, where we have some common points, among them is probably Syria is the most important. There was the so-called Da Nang Declaration signed by Putin and Trump in Vietnam, where both sides confirmed that they are interested to have a united, multi-ethnical, multi-religious, democratic Syria and so on, so that nobody will be playing in order to break Syria into pieces, and so that we are interested in the restoration of Syria as a single and United States state. And so I think that this is a certain basis for a dialogue. Now, of course, comes the issue that Russia and the United States supported different sides in this war. That's absolutely evident. And, of course, the issue of President Assad. To my mind, today, Obama's stand that Mr. Assad's days are numbered and he should leave tomorrow, I think it was uttered in March 2012. They are not very pertinent because Mr. Obama is out of the White House and Mr. Assad is still in Damascus. So we have to take facts as they are. And so I think the call for Assad to step down, if it is formulated by anyone today, would be completely irrealistic. On the other hand, no, I don't think, and Russians don't think they can do it alone in Syria, be it only for the reason that there are too many actors in Syria. And if you ask for partners, we are quite interested in the United States to take part in the so-called Astana process. But unfortunately, the United States don't want to take part in this process. And at some point, they were considering a possibility of sending a delegation, and then they revoked this possibility. Russia is also discussing these issues with Mr. Erdogan, with Turkey. Turkey is a very important factor in Syria, as you know.
So I think, yes, the United States and Turkey probably are the partners we need. Of course, backing from the European Union would be a good thing to have, but I don't see a lot of presence of the European Union in the Syrian issue. So the question is, how do we do it? Whether there will be still, you know, this desire to oust Mr. Assad, which I think cannot be fulfilled, or we will proceed to this political settlement through more complicated stages than just, you know, this call for a complete change of power in Damascus, which is unrealistic. But in principle, we always signal to the American side, and during the context between Putin and Trump, this was always confirmed from the Russian side that we are interested to have talks with the United States on Syria.
Well, what's Russia willing to give up then? Because I mean, if you're saying you want international partners, you need international partners, as far as that's concerned, to what extent is Russia willing to make concessions to those international partners? For instance, if you have Germany as one, contributing money to rebuilding Syria. Obviously, Germany has an interest because they've got a lot of Syrian refugees here. Could you soften up your stance towards Assad? Would you soften up your stance or change your stance maybe towards Iran, put more pressure on them? What's Russia willing to do? Because Russia holds the cards, right? Russia is the main actor in there right now. It balances out Israel, Iran, all these places in this powder keg. What are you willing to give?
Look, we are probably today the only power which talks to everybody in the Middle East, to Netanyahu, to Tehran, to the King of Jordan, to the Saudis, to the Qataris, to the Turks. In this respect, yes, we have some cards, but let's not overestimate. We cannot say to the Iranians, who have been in Syria long before we came there in 2015, and who played a very big role in supporting Assad, we cannot tell them to leave Syria. You know, it will not work. We can, for instance, listening to Israel, we can offer some assistance in, for instance, bringing the Iranian forces a little bit further from the border so that Israel does not feel threatened. But it's quite another issue to tell the Iranians that they should leave a place where they're quite welcomed by the official government when they have played a very big role in fighting this very terrorist threat, which was very much present and is still present in Syria. So we have the cards, but we don't completely command the game. And that's why I think that exactly we need a very complicated equation for this movement further. And of course, we cannot reconsider our position on Mr. Assad today, because he has an army of 150,000 people, you know, who is working well rather efficiently in the last years, and so he's in power there, and he has a popular support. I remember when John Kerry at some point said, "Yes, Assad has the support of the part of the Syrian population. That's a fact." So we are not in a commanding position to say people, you know, to Iranians do that, to Assad to do this, and so on. It's a much more complicated combination.
Have I missed anybody here? Well, then I think we're already out of time. But I want one more question to Rose Gotemiller, because we've been talking about, you know, negotiating with Russia, speaking with Russia. Mm-hmm. Who's going to take the lead on that? Because so far I've heard from Mr. Graf Lambsdorff, yeah, you know, we want to talk to Russia. I've heard from you. You want to talk to Russia. Who's going to take the lead?
What do you mean on what?
On starting that process. It seems as though right now there's mechanisms there, but there's nobody willing to take the lead on trying to improve the relations. Well, is it the American side? Can NATO play a role? Can the Russians play a role?
It always makes sense, just as I said, to define exactly what you're talking about. What's the goal you're trying to achieve in any dialogue or any negotiation? Then you figure out how, what's the best way to negotiate. I've heard a lot of questions, you know, is it possible with today's administration in Washington? There are a number of very talented people in today's administration in Washington. I feel quite sure if the negotiation is well defined to take account of the interests of all parties, then the negotiating talent would be found.
All right. Thank you very much, folks, for listening in, and thank you to all the panelists. And I'm not sure what the next point of the order is, but I hope you have a great conference. Thank you.